Welcome to the Back Issue Banter Podcast. We're your hosts, Brad Page
and Chris Caron. Each episode, we'll look back at some of our favorite issues and storylines, along with the creators behind those books, celebrating what we love about comics.
So grab those trade paperbacks off the bookshelf, rummage through your long boxes, or fire up your digital reader and join us for some Back Issue Banter.
Welcome to Back Issue Banter, the podcast where Chris and Brad talk about comics.
Yay! I'm Brad Page.
And today we're going to talk about one of my favorite all-time stories by one of my all-time favorite comic book creator teams. And I'm talking about a saga that starts with Batman issue 232 from 1971 and concludes in Batman 242 through 244 from 1972. This, of course, especially 232, is the very first appearance of a villain who will go on to become very significant in the Batman villains pantheon, as it were, Ra's al Ghul. Yep. And this saga was written by Denny O'Neil and drawn by the Neil Adams, both of whom passed within the last few years. And we'll get a little more into their backstories as we go forward. But
Batman number 232, Daughter of the Demon. Written by Denny O'Neil, penciled by Neil Adams, inked by Dick Giordano. Our story opens with Robin getting shot. Batman receives a photo of Robin with a note that he's been captured. When Batman arrives at the Batcave, he discovers that Ra's al Ghul is waiting for him there. Ra's says his daughter Talia has also been captured and he needs Batman's help. Batman had met Talia before, back in Detective Comics number 411. Batman eventually deduces that Ra's al Ghul has orchestrated the whole thing. It was all a test to see if Batman was a worthy successor to Ra's empire and worthy of Talia's love.
Before we say anything else, Brad, I'm going to just say that I would have to say that Neil Adams is probably my favorite Batman artist of all time. I saw his work back in the day when he was doing it. And, you know, I didn't really know who artists were back then. But I could recognize different styles. And, you know, like I thought it was funny how in some of the 50s Batman almost looked fat. He looked very barrel chested.
Yeah.
In contrast, Neil Adams, you know, drew what is generally regarded as a photorealistic style.
Yeah, it's not really, but compared to what the majority of artists were doing at that time, Neil's stuff felt very, very grounded, very realistic. He's one of the greats and innovative too. This issue has a great cover.
Yes.
That features sort of in the background, this image of Ra's, or I guess technically it's supposed to be pronounced Ra's al Ghul. I don't know.
I've heard that, but you know,
I grew up calling him Ra's al Ghul.
Ra's al Ghul doesn't sound right to me because I'm just so used to, I'm going to call him Ra's. I don't care if we want to call him.
So anyway, he's sort of in the background of this cover shot, and that's done a technique that's called penciled halftone. It really hadn't been done much or if at all in comics at that point. And so, you know, not only was he a great artist, but he was an innovative, he was bringing a lot of new techniques and approaches and styles and panel layouts and things like that to the form. It's absolutely a key issue. Talia had actually been introduced previously. Her first appearance was in Detective 411, Detective Comics. And for those of you who may not be super aficionados on Batman comics history at the time and still today, there were two Batman comic books being published monthly. So every month you'd have two different Batman comic books you could buy from the stands. There would be the comic titled Batman, and then there would be Detective Comics, which was actually where Batman first appeared in Detective Comics 27. So you knew every month you were at least going to get two new issues of Batman. Talia first appeared in Detective 411 and mentioned her father, but he didn't appear. This is where Ra's al Ghul actually first appears. There's actually a little scene in there, like a one pager, where they retell Batman's origin.
Yes.
And that was something that Neil Adams stuck in there. It was not in Denny's original script, but he just wanted to do it. He wanted to retell the origin. And sort of an interesting thing about that is that in the original origin, as we all know, Martha and Thomas Wayne are shot in Crime Alley, right?
Right.
The pearls going flying and all of that. But somewhere along the line, that had been tweaked, that Thomas was shot and Martha had a heart attack, that she hadn't been shot. And this retelling of it brought it back full circle around to where they both get shot. And of course, that has stuck ever since then. But, you know, it's just an example of how these guys came in to return Batman to his really original roots. And you want to talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah. Well, you know,
how we get to these books.
Well, I read something somewhere a while back that made a great, excellent point. A lot of people attribute the current incarnation of Batman, the Dark Knight Batman, to Frank Miller in the Dark Knight Returns. But where it really got its start was here. I mean, late 60s, early 70s with Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams. I mean, you know, Denny O'Neill, you know, also one of the great Batman writers, the great, you know, he later became a Batman editor during a very controversial time, as you all know, with the whole death of Robin and stuff. But, you know, at this point, he was just kind of he was writing the book on a fairly regular basis, I believe. These guys came in to basically say, OK, no more POW, no more Zap, no more, you know, camp. We're going back to the roots of this character. They did so in a story in Detective Comics. I don't remember the exact issue, but it was, the story is a really good one called The Secret of the Waiting Graves.
Yes.
And it takes place in Mexico of all places. And it's like, but you get this, like, they returned Batman to being a creature of the night. There was a story that went around that even if a scene took place in daytime, Neil Adams drew it at night.
Yeah. So, how we get here, just expanding on what you were saying, is that towards the end of the 50s, early 60s, Batman was really wasn't selling that great. And they started to do those kind of imaginary Superman type tales, you know, where there was a, you know, I don't know, it's all crazy stuff to be like a zebra Batman and and you know, when Batman morphs into a fly or whatever, they're all this crazy weird science fiction stuff. And at that point, they decided to revamp things, and they came up with what they called the New Look Batman. And that's where the bat symbol that we all know and love, the image of the bat in the yellow oval on his chest, was introduced then. And then we had the Batman TV show around the same time, and then things started to get really campy. And then when the TV show went off the air, the sales of the Batman comic books tanked again. So it was time for another revamp. And this is, they started, and this, to give credit where credit's due, I think this really kind of came from editorial, from like Julia Schwartz, because they had to save the book, you know, they had to do something. And they, so they started talking about the big change. That's what they called this. And in letter pages, they would say, you know, coming soon, the big change. And it actually began earlier, slightly earlier, in, I believe it was Batman number 217, where they send Robin off to college.
Yep.
So they get Robin out of the picture. Batman decides to board up Wayne Manor, abandon the Batcave, and move to the Wayne Foundation building in the center of Gotham. And they have this penthouse on the top where he moves. And you know, just all throwing a bunch of stuff in, getting rid of a bunch of old stuff, and just trying to refresh the book. And that that stuff kind of happens really a little bit before Denny and Neil get there. But But once they get there, they really go full force and bring this whole new look and approach. And you're absolutely correct. Neil Adams, actually about a year before these issues here happened, Neil was working on Batman Brave and the Bold, which was yet another Batman comic, but this was a team up book. So every issue would be Batman teaming with Green Arrow or Batman teaming with Black Canary or whatever. And Neil started drawing all those stories at night, even though it wasn't in the script. But Neil would draw them as night scenes because he wanted to bring Batman back to that, you know, the Dark Knight, the Avenger, all of that kind of stuff. And so this stuff was kind of creeping in there, but it's really when Denny and Neil get together and start work. And I believe that issue you're talking about was Detective Comics 395, where they really brought that. Yeah, that was the issue. So we're a few issues ahead of that. Right. They've really established their style and their look. And Neil completely came up with the look for Ra's al Ghul.
Right.
Denny really didn't dictate any look for him. That was, you know, it's a great character design.
Yes. Very, very iconic, very like mysterious. You look at the guy and you know he's somebody of substance. You know he's
right.
A big deal. He's not some like TV villain, like, hey, it's the Clock King or the Puzzler. This is a guy who means business. And one thing I wanted to bring up about Neil Adams that kind of a side note, you were mentioning how prior to doing, you know, Batman with Neil Adams, I'm sorry, with Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams was drawing him for the Brave and the Bold. Well, they started getting letters, or Brutally Short started getting letters saying, hey, how come you don't have the real Batman in this book? Or why don't you have Neil Adams drawing this book? And I think initially he was a resistant, but he got so much mail saying that the Batman in Brave and the Bold was so much better, or better drawn. And that's what leads you to this. And, you know, by this point, you know, Denny and Neil had been doing this for a little while. They've done a few issues here and there, you know, never consistently though. There's like, not like a consistent, like 20 issue run by these guys. There's like little spots of it, but then other writers come in. But I think Denny was probably writing a lot of the issues. I'd have to really look, but Neil definitely did these issues. And I first came upon these books in a reprint in a limited collector's edition from 1977, which is also known as the equivalent of Marvel's Treasury Edition, which had these four stories. Now, in the late 80s, early 90s, when the Ra's character was starting to make a comeback, they published a trade paperback called Tales of the Demon, which actually has not only these stories, but more stories from in and around that era.
Yeah.
But I really feel that these four issues distill it down to its essence. The other stories, you know, you've got artists like Frank Robbins, who, you know, is kind of not everybody's cup of tea. He was okay. And you have all these other stories from, and some of them which take place after this, you know, again, they're okay. But this, you know, I feel like these four issues are the ones that matter. And 232, in fact, within the last couple of years, was reprinted in one of those replica editions or facsimile editions. Of course, I bought it, you know. Because you get all the, like, you know, as we've discussed before, when you get those facsimile editions, you not only get the original story, you get all the original ads, letters, pages, and, you know, so it's interesting to see that, you know, for only 5 cents, you can, you know, get a,
Sometimes those are as much fun as the content of the book itself, looking at the old ads, and you get the old letters, pages. One of the interesting things about this issue we're talking about here, 232, is I believe that there's a letter in there from a fan named Mike W. Barr.
Oh, yes.
Who a few years later would go on to actually become a comic book writer and be the regular writer on Batman.
Yeah. But,
you know, here he is probably still a kid or a teenager. Yeah. and he's writing fan letters in.
Yep.
And I just, I love, and you run across that a lot in these old comics where,
oh yeah,
you know, I love to scan the letters pages, because a lot of times you'll see names that you recognize of guys who eventually went on to pursue their dream and get into the business. And I think that's great.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And this issue, I mean, they really make, you know, they really make sure that Roz makes a stunning debut. Like I said, when you look at him, when you come upon his visage, you're immediately taken with the fact that this is a guy, a man of authority. This is a guy who means business. He is not to be trifled with.
Well, not only that, but that he's Batman's equal in so many ways.
Yeah, he figured it out. I mean,
they first meet in the Batcave.
Yeah, he's gotten inside the Batcave.
Right.
Nobody gets inside the Batcave unless Batman brings them there as a captive.
Right, right. And as we said, at this point, Bruce Wayne is actually not in Wayne Manor. He's not in the Batcave.
But
right?
He goes
he's
back
living,
there, too.
Right. He's living downtown in the penthouse, but he will occasionally go back to use the computers and stuff in the Batcave. And so he goes there to do his detective work. And Ra's al Ghul is already there and has deduced that Batman is Bruce Wayne. So, you know, you get right away in their first introduction that this guy has an intellect and skill and ability to match the great Batman, which is rare, right?
Right. And of course he's brought along his bodyguard and thug, a giant god man by the name of Ubu, who is
he's the muscle,
you know, muscular kind of guy who's, you know, who always insists that whenever they go somewhere that Al Ghul has to lead first, you know, infidel, you will not, you know, go in front of my lord and master. You know, of course when you're Ra's al Ghul, you got to have somebody watching your, you know, keeping an eye on you, because, you know, there's probably a lot of people who want to take him out, so to speak.
Right.
But it's, they end up going to Calcutta, and, you know, of course they get there, they go across mountains and it's treacherous and they get shot at. Then they finally come upon Robin, and it turns out Robin's not dead. He was shot at, but apparently maybe it was blanks or just whatever.
Tranquilizers.
Yeah. And he's okay. He's tied up, but he's okay. He's like, yeah, the chow's lousy though. Could use a better atmosphere. This show kind of making him a little bit of a wisecracker. Mm-hmm. Batman, of course, gets him free. They have a big fight. And then Batman says, basically tells Ra's al Ghul, you know, this has been a ruse all along. This whole thing.
You're not fooling me.
Yeah. You know, Ubu making sure you went first, except when it was dangerous. Like, there's one scene where they're going into a place where there's a trained tiger waiting to kill him. And of course, they're nowhere to be seen. He just goes in there and the tiger gets sicked on him. He, you know, takes care of the tiger in short order. But he basically tells Al Ghul, you know, I know that this was all made up and this is all a ruse. And then Al Ghul says to him, well, you know, I wanted to see if you were a worthy successor to my throne and a, you know, worthy husband for my daughter. And like, he's totally caught off guard by this.
Right.
And this kind of neatly foreshadows some stuff that's going to happen many years down the line. But I really felt that this is an introduction to the character. Was very effective. I thought the storytelling was great. Neil Adams, like I said, he's my favorite Batman artist.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely in my top two. If I had to, you know, I can't think of anyone I'd pick above him. I mean, there's a lot of great Batman artists from that era.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's very significant. And this brings a character who over time will become one of the biggest villains in the Batman villains pantheon, as I discussed before. You know, but prior to this, you know, if you said Batman villains, people would say Joker, Penguin, Catwoman,
right?
Penguin, because, you know, the TV show, everybody knew most people knew those villains from the TV show. Maybe Mr. Freeze, but those are the big four. Well, Ra's al Ghul will eventually assume stature, you know, almost equivalent to them. He'll even be the main villain in a Batman film, but that's going to be several years away at that point.
Right. But yeah, he's a fascinating character because he's a villain, but he's not, you know, he's one of those villains with a point.
Yeah.
You know, because he's essentially trying to save the world. But, you know, one of those guys that believes the only way to save the world is for me to rule it.
And to
You
extinguish
know,
anybody who like doesn't rise up to, my level
right,
or,
but he's not out for money or
No, he's not.
fame or
No, he's not. Yeah. Most.
vengeance or anything like that. He, you know, he's trying to, he thinks he's a hero.
Yes. He sees,
Which,
yeah, he sees himself as completely noble, a
yes.
certain bearing, like I have the world's best interest at heart. He's got this organization, I think back then it was known as the Brotherhood of the Demon. It becomes later known as the League of Shadows. And we over the years we'll find out more and more about Ra's origin and how he came to be. But you know enough in this story where you automatically sort of like realize this character has a certain gravitas. This is not.
Right, he's not your run-of-the-mill villain, you know, just a crazy killer psycho like the
Right.
Joker or a criminal mastermind like the Penguin or what. You know, he's a whole different ball of wax, and his relationship with Batman is complex because
Yeah, to say the least.
he doesn't want Batman. He wants Batman to be his heir, right?
Yeah.
Not his enemy, but of course Batman chooses to fight him rather than to join him. But you know, there's all this sort of grudging respect between the two of them. And then you have Talia in the mix, and it's a classic, you know, it's a tale told a thousand times through the centuries, right? Of, you know, she's on one hand, she's trying to follow in the footsteps of her father. On the other hand, she's in love with her father's sworn enemy, you know. And it's so you have this, it's not a love triangle in that sense, but it is a triangle, right? Of these three
Yes.
characters who are interdependent, and it was just such a breath of fresh air into the Batman mythology at that point. And you know, as you said, it's still a key element of the stories up to today, enough that it, like you said, they were characters in the Christopher Nolan films. So,
Well,
you know.
Talia is not like Catwoman, where it's like always a kind of a tease, but she never really follows through. She's always trying to get him to, Catwoman's always trying to get Batman on her side, especially in the TV show, but he never succumbs. Whereas you can see that he's got feelings for Talia. There's something about her that he, as a man, is attracted to. And let's face it, the way she's drawn, you can see why. So it's not a simple thing where she's a femme fatale who tries to entice him and it doesn't work and he just casts her aside. This is going to be ramifications for this, and there's going to be storylines in years to come that are going to kind of build on this to, interesting effect, especially with the current state of Batman and, the character of Damian. But that's several years away. But I thought this was a very solid introduction. The character of Ubu, he's a really good thug in that he's just all about business, and he's all about his lord and master, leading the way in every way, except of course when there's danger afoot. But
Right.
and Batman pretty much makes short work of him. But yeah, very solid introduction. And the funny thing about this is that they don't follow up on this for till the following year in Batman number 242, which is a title Bruce Wayne, Rest in Peace. This one is written by Denny O'Neill. The penciler on this one, though, is Irv Novik. Neil Adams was apparently out of town for this issue, or was, I don't know exactly what happened, but.
Well, I think I was having what I've read about. I was, I think, an interview with Denny O'Neill where he talked about that these guys were all more or less freelancers. And so you'd
Yes.
show up at the DC office and you'd basically be handed your assignment. And, you know, for Denny, 9 times out of 10, it would be Batman, but not always. Sometimes they'd hand him something else. So,
Yeah.
you know, who knows? You know, that, Irv Novik may have showed up a day or two ahead of Neil, and therefore got the assignment on this issue. You
Yeah,
know,
we don't know.
it's Marvel was a little more consistent with having
Yeah.
artists assigned to books for longer periods of
Yes,
time,
yes.
and writers, whereas it seems with DC it was more luck of the draw, you
Yeah,
know.
okay, who can we get to write this issue,
Right,
Yeah.
right. So anyway, yes, written by Denny O'Neill, penciled by Irv Novik, and inked by Dick Giordano.
Yes.
Who inked also 232, which we talked about.
Yeah, great artist and very underrated.
Great art, yeah, and inker. A very important person in the history of DC Comics. But
very much so, yeah.
Batman number 242, Bruce Wayne, rest in peace. Written by Denny O'Neill, penciled by Irv Novik, inks by Dick Giordano. Commissioner Gordon and Batman discuss the latest newspaper headline, Bruce Wayne vanishes, believed dead. It's all a ruse so that Batman can leave the country on an extended mission to find Ra's al Ghul. He assembles a team to assist him, including a gangster named Matches Malone. But when Malone gets shot, Batman assumes his identity. Also joining them is a scientist named Dr. Blaine and Li Ying, a former underling of Ra's al Ghul. Yeah, I think the key thing in this issue is the introduction of the Matches Malone character. This is his first appearance. He's rather unceremoniously offed almost immediately in a very awkward scene that's it's not very clear what's going on.
Right. But
essentially, Batman goes to recruit this guy. He ends up getting killed by accident, but then Batman decides, well, he can take over Matches Malone's identity. And this is something that gets used going forward.
Yes.
If you've ever watched the Batman animated series that was on in the 90s, like Matches Malone, that sort of third secret identity appeared in that show. So it's this character of Matches Malone had legs, which is kind of interesting, but this is where we first see that character. But this kind of sets up where we go over the next two issues, where Batman sort of assembles this ragtag team who then head off out of the country to Switzerland, I think, to track down Ra's al Ghul, which gets us to the next issue.
What's interesting is that in this issue, you know, as we discussed, the artwork is by Irv Novik, who does a fine job. You know, it's
good. It
compliments, you know, the previous issue very well. It's well done. It's, you know, it's not Neil Adams, but it's good enough. It suffices. And, you know, this is really a setup. We don't really see Ra's. We hear about him.
Right.
But that's the thing that's interesting about Ra's. He's such a presence and he's such a strong character that even in an issue where he doesn't actually have a physical presence, you're still thinking about him. Obviously, right. Batman knows he's got to go after this guy to the point where he's faked his own death. I mean, Bruce Wayne's death, rather. And that will, be followed up in a later issue. But, you know, for now, he needs to have the freedom to sort of say, be able to go after Ra's without, you know, being outed as being Bruce Wayne, you know, which would be a disaster at this point. You know, this was a pretty solid issue. You know, we are introduced to some new characters, Dr. Blaine, who is very reluctant to kind of come on board as, you know, this plot to get Ra's. And then we meet Lo Ling, you know, who is this, you know, assassin, kind of like a bodyguard assassin who's out to get the doctor. And, you know, he fights Batman almost to the death. But now he's, you know, his loyalty is divided, and that's going to be explored in the next issue. And now we go to Batman number 343, which is from August 1972, The Lazarus Pit. Boy, what a title for a very significant, part of the mythos, the Ra's al Ghul mythos.
Batman number 243, The Lazarus Pit. Written by Denny O'Neill, penciled by Neil Adams, inked by Dick Giordano. Batman must first win Li Ying's loyalty in a duel. Once that's decided, his team heads to Switzerland, where they meet Molly Post, international ski champion, who joins their quest. But when they finally arrive at Ra's al Ghul's secret mountain hideout, they discover that Ra's is already dead. As they leave, Talia presses a hidden button, lowering Ra's al Ghul's body into the Lazarus Pit.
So, Brad, what did you think of this issue?
Well, as you said, it introduces a key part of the not only of the Ra's al Ghul backstory, the Lazarus Pit, but that becomes just part of the general Batman mythology.
Right.
And beyond that, like if you watch the TV show Arrow, the Lazarus Pit was multiple times used in that show. So it's a big part of DC mythology. And this idea that Ra's al Ghul, whenever he gets mortally wounded, they just dunk him in the Lazarus Pit. And he comes out, whenever he comes out, he's like turned up to 11.
Yes.
He's in like this mad rabid dog state where he's got the strength of 10 men and he's just out of control, violent.
Yeah.
And has to basically just kind of burn that energy off. I like to think of it, I don't know if you have dogs, but I have a couple of dogs and sometimes they get what we call the zoomies, where they just have to run around the house like maniacs until they get the energy out of their system. Yeah. And so Ra's comes out of the Lazarus Pit and he's got the zoomies. He's got,
definitely. He's a man possessed.
Yeah. And so not a ton happens in this issue.
No, it's a lot of setup.
It's pretty much all setup. And they never explain what exactly happened to Ra's and it's a little weird.
Yeah.
Because they walk into this, they go all the way to Switzerland and, you know, hike up through the Alps or whatever and find his mountain lair.
Of course, it's always a mountain lair.
Right, right. And they get in there and Ra's is laying dead on this table. And then they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's over. Good thing that's done, you know, all set.
Yeah.
With no question about like, wait a minute, what happened? It's a little bit of funky storytelling there, but the key thing is it gets us to the Lazarus Pit, which has become a key element in the Batman and larger DC mythology.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, once again, this was written by Denny O'Neill and drawn by Neil Adams. Yes, he's back, folks. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, I love Neil Adams' art. You know, like I said, we talked about the whole photorealistic thing. And, you know, they have Batman traveling to like Switzerland. I was listening to a podcast about this on the Fire and Water Network, and they were talking about how one of the guys who was commentating said he felt like this almost felt like a James Bond story.
Yes.
Where Batman is kind of getting out of the country. It's in multiple countries and locations. And he's this international intrigue. And, you know, not Ra's al Ghul is this kind of mysterious, kind of villain or whatever you want to call him. In this issue, there's not a lot going on. It's just basically to set it up for the final chapter. But, you know, it's very well drawn, very well written. I mean, I think Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams were in the zone at this time. They had really taken control of Batman and really were showing everybody, this is how you do it. This is the way Batman should be done in the 1970s. You know, you got to remember, these stories, folks, were 50 years ago. This, you know, and yeah. You know, we were kids back then. I didn't actually read them when they first came out, but I did read them later on, like I said, in collected editions. And, you know, like I said, Batman 232 recently or within the last couple of years did get republished. I don't know why they don't republish the whole saga. It'd be nice if they did these. You know me, Brad, as many reprints of this story as I have, I'll buy another one if they publish it. But
I've got a couple of the originals. I do have a reprint series that came out on what they used to call Baxter paper.
Yes.
Which was a slightly nicer version of not just newsprint.
Yeah. But
that came out in the late 80s, early 90s, I think. I forget what that was called. It was like a three or four issue.
Yeah. That was
reprinted these issues.
Yeah. And that's what they basically use as the basis for the trade paperback that came out a little later.
They probably just bound those together.
Yeah. And I think it might even reprint those covers for those versions because they had new covers
Yeah, convincing. Neil did new covers, I believe.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, it's a good issue. It's very solid storytelling. You get some international intrigue with them kind of scaling the Alps. And I forgot to mention also, there's a really interesting character called Molly Post.
Yes, I was going to bring up Molly. When you were talking about the James Bond aspect of it, she's a very James Bond girl type of character, right? She's a professional or like a competitive skier, like an Olympic skier. And somehow she gets tied up. She gets roped into this whole thing. They meet at the airport, and her ex-boyfriend or something was somehow tied up with Ra's al Ghul. So she has it out for Ra's al Ghul, and she talks herself onto the plane and ends up on this adventure with Batman. And but the whole look of her and the way she's presented in the story is it's a very Bond-like character.
I could almost, it's funny. There's an actress who I could imagine playing her, Jill St. John.
Yes.
And she was not only a Bond girl, but significantly, Jill St. John appeared in the very first two episodes of the Batman 66 show and is the only character on that TV show who died. It was a very funny, thing where she disguised herself as Robin. Apparently, the costume flattened out her breasts and everything. And once she gets inside the Batcave, she pulls a gun on Batman. She goes to escape him, and she runs up the atomic pile. And of course, she somehow, like, she's dangling precipitously, and then she, falls in. But I could picture Jill St. John playing. And I definitely agree with whoever said this on Fire and Water that there's a cinematic quality, a James Bond kind of feel to it. Yeah. They're getting Batman. He's not just fighting the Joker in the annals of Gotham. He's taking this worldwide because this is a worldwide opponent, who has he's like part of an underground that's worldwide.
Right. Right.
And with that, we're going to go to the next issue, Batman number 244 from September of 1972. And this story is called The Demon Lives Again, appropriately enough. Once again, written by Denny O'Neill, penciled by Neil Adams, and inked by Dick Giordano. And I should also mention that the editor on all these issues is, of course, someone we've mentioned many times before on the show, the late, great Julie Schwartz, who seemed to have a knack for kind of reinventing characters with Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams. There was also, simultaneously with this or around this time, there was also, the Green Arrow and Green Lantern. That's a series we should talk about at some point. But
yeah, absolutely. Batman number 244, The Demon Lives Again. Written by Denny O'Neill, penciled by Neil Adams, inked by Dick Giordano. The Lazarus Pit brings Ra's al Ghul back to life, but the side effects of the resurrection send him into a murderous rage. He beats Batman and escapes with Talia. With his team injured, Batman leaves them behind and tracks Ra's al Ghul to the desert, where he faces him alone. A brutal sword fight ensues, but when Batman is bitten by a scorpion, Ra's leaves him to die. But Talia gives Batman the antidote via a kiss, and Batman recovers and defeats Ra's al Ghul.
Brad, what did you think of the final part of this saga called The Demon Lives Again?
Well, I'm a little bit biased, maybe, but this is probably my favorite issue of the bunch, just because it does wrap up the story, and I think a pretty satisfying ending. This is an issue that I bought maybe off the rack or very early on. Had to be one of the first comics that I ever bought. And I still have that. I still have this issue.
That cover is eye-catching. I mean, you see Ra's al Ghul standing over a supposedly dead Batman with a knife sticking out of him.
Yes, which is a scene that doesn't actually happen in the book.
but it grabs your attention, though.
It does. And it's notable for a few things. And Neil Adams actually got some flack from DC management because he drew Batman on the cover with hairy chest and nipples.
which
oh my God,
which
the children.
Like, yeah. And look at that cover again, and we'll post this on the Facebook page so you can look along with us. But do you have it in front of you, Chris?
Yeah, I do. I kind of like a small clip of it. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, Batman's laying there with a sword in his chest. He's got no shirt on, but he's got a cowl and he's got pants on. Right. Yeah. But what is Ra's al Ghul holding up?
Oh, you're right. He's holding up the whole suit.
He's holding up the whole outfit.
You're right. That's meaning
that Batman apparently wears two pairs of pants, one underneath his actual costume. And that was pointed out to me by Neil Adams himself.
Really?
I was at a convention, a Boston comic convention.
Wow.
And he had a bunch of posters that he was selling and signing. And he had a poster of that cover. And of course, because that was one of the first comics that I ever bought, well, I had to buy the poster. So as I was paying him for the poster, the $20 or whatever it was for the poster, he pointed that out. It's something that I had never noticed. But he made some joke about, like the Batman apparently wears two pairs of pants. But that's because they made him made the coloring people color in pants on the Batman laying on the ground.
Yeah, okay, that explains it.
Because, you know, it would have been too suggestive to have a naked Batman on the cover. He got enough flack just for the hairy chest and nipples. They couldn't have him with no pants on.
Right, but nobody in like editorial like thought to maybe modify the cut, you know, say to Neil, why don't you, you know, crop the, you know, the pants out of, well, you know.
Yeah, or Neil probably said, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
And so they just went.
I can see Neil saying that. He was
painted his legs gray to make it look like he's got pants on. But
you know, I never noticed that.
That's one of those great, you
50,
know.
50 years later, I'm finally noticing this for the first time.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I've read that book many times.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was at least 25 years before, and it was Neil Adams who pointed it out. Otherwise, I wouldn't have noticed it either, probably. But yes, it's a classic story. You know, just the final sword fight between Ra's al Ghul and Batman's pretty iconic. He doesn't get stabbed as he appears on the cover. Batman gets bitten by a scorpion in the middle of the fight.
Yeah.
And Ra's leaves him to die. But Talia gives Batman a final kiss. And she has a scorpion antidote on her lips.
Of course
she
does. Of course she does. Prepare for everything. That almost sounds like something out of the TV show.
Right.
Like you almost expect, like she should have held up in a panel like, anti-scorpion transferable.
I pulled it out of her belt or something.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then like then held it up and like have a close-up panel, you know, and you know, then you see her spraying her lips. And yeah, this was a really well done finale. Like I said, you know, there's you have the Baxter series like you talked about, and then the trade paper where they have more stories to sort of fill it out a little bit. I think what this is, these four issues are the essence of it. That's what they chose to reprint mm-hmm. in that 1977 limited collector's edition, which has a absolutely gorgeous cover, wraparound cover that spans the back and the front, where you see, like, how did you describe Ra's the way he was drawn on Batman 232? Was, how did you say, there was something tone or
it's called a penciled half tone.
Okay. Very similar.
That background,
you see the grinning visage of Ra's al Ghul in the background. And Batman has kneeled over Robin like he's crying, like, and it appears to give the impression that Robin is lying there dead. Mm-hmm. And Talia is just standing there. And, you know, one thing about Talia, especially the way she's been drawn in the last two issues, man, I think it might have been in the last issue where she's trying to sneak up on Batman. She's wearing these thigh high boots, very 70s style. Mm-hmm. And man, talk about sexy. I mean, I didn't, you know, think about stuff like that when I was reading these as a little kid, but as I got older, you realize Neil Adams, I mean, talk about photorealistic. He drew very attractive women. Molly Post is very attractive, but yeah. Talia is like, you know, you could see
Talia's in a whole nother.
Yeah.
She's exotic looking.
Yeah. Very much so.
You know, we don't really know Middle Eastern, Asian.
Yeah, exactly.
We really don't know like the lineage, because again, Ra's al Ghul is probably 500 years old. So
did he? I think it was Neil Adams said that when he drew Ra's al Ghul, he wanted to keep him kind of vague in terms of like what his ethnicity might be.
Right.
He wanted to give him a face that was kind of universal. And tellingly, and I didn't, you know, he drew him with no eyebrows.
Yes.
Maybe the Lazarus Pit, you know, that's a side effect of the Lazarus Pit. I don't know.
Right.
But yes, he, you know, so they're drawn kind of vaguely, you know, Asian or Middle Eastern or whatever. And I think in a way, the fact that we don't know where they're from exactly or what their ethnic lineage is kind of works in favor of the characters.
It's better that we don't.
But at the end of the story, you know, Batman wins, of course, and Ra's al Ghul is ostensibly going to be taken to justice. I don't know exactly where you'd take him. I mean, do you take him to the World Court? Do you take him to Gotham City?
Right.
I mean, and you know, we all know that Ra's will show up in future installments. I mean, he doesn't die in this, but like, you know, establishing the Lazarus Pit in the last issue really sets it up so that, you know, anytime they need him, hey, you know, take a dip. You know, you're feeling a little dead today. You're not feeling good. No problem. And then, like, you know, he comes out, like you said, turned up to 11. You know, he's just crazed. And Neil Adams draws him that way. Like, he's at a point where he's so crazed, like, he's just so in the zone that Talia at one point says, Dad, are you there, Dad? You know, she has to kind of, like, really.
She's the only one who can
talk to him. She's the one who can talk to him and get him kind of to snap out of it a little bit. And we don't even really know exactly what his plans are or what he's going to do. We'll find out more about Ra's and
We don't learn a lot about Ra's in these books, but we just general idea that he's the leader of some centuries old League of Assassins, but he's got some agenda.
Yes.
That's not just crime.
No, I guess he's known in later issues as an eco-terrorist.
Right.
You know, which, of course, is very timely and very, you know, in time with, you know, what's going on now. But, you know, and you think about it, like, I always, when the Batman movies were coming out, I always wondered, you know, I thought I'd love to see Ra's al Ghul in a Batman movie. But I said, they'll never do it. He's too obscure, but they did. I mean, it was not exactly a direct adaptation. They took some liberties with it.
Yeah. I'm not in love with it, what they did in the first. No? I like the first film, but, and this is something that I'll say probably every episode of this podcast is that the movies are great. Yes. I enjoy the movies and the TV shows, but these characters are the best in the comics.
They live, breathe. They really live and breathe.
Right. I don't, you know, Robert Downey Jr. was great as Iron Man, but you know, the Tony Stark and Iron Man in the comic books, that's my Tony Stark and Iron Man, you know?
Right. Like even if they made, like they directly adapted these issues into a movie, it could be very well done, but it's never going to have the same kind of sweep or the same kind of, you know, like they did like animated movies based on Dark Knight Returns and The Killing Joke. And they were both done okay. But there's something about those original books that you can't. It's like when you read a good novel, a really great novel, and they adapt it into a really good movie. As good as the movie may be, the book 9 times out of 10 is much better. And that applies to comic books because, like, you know, in a comic book before the last 20, 30 years, filmmakers were limited to what they could do with comic book heroes. You know, you had to use practical effects. Now with CGI, you know, they can kind of match what's in the comic books. And in some ways it's almost a little too easy, but I really liked these stories. I think they really did a great job of establishing this character was. Yet at the same time, you know something about him, but you don't know everything about him. And that's going to fall upon later writers to flesh out in subsequent stories. But I don't think any of those stories had the same impact as these. These were just the ones that really, you know, Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams, come on. This was the dream team. My only regret is that, you know, they didn't do more issues of Batman. Like they weren't on a more consistent basis. Like they didn't do like a 2-year, you know, consecutive run. But like you said, I think it was basically back then because they didn't really have a continuity per se. It was just like whoever shows up that Friday, you know, looking for an assignment. Okay, you can write this issue of Batman, or you can, draw this issue.
Right. And it, at that time, I think that changed later, but during the early 70s, that's kind of how it was. But yeah, I mean, these guys are two comic book legends. Neil Adams was born in 1941, kind of got his start doing a comic strip, the Ben Casey comic strip. Worked in commercial art, actually kind of worked at DC and Marvel simultaneously. He was one of the first people to do that publicly. Other artists would do it, but they would use a fake name when they worked, you know, they'd use their real name with DC and a fake name when they worked for Marvel, because they were afraid they'd get canned by one of the other ones. But Neil said screw that, he was going to be Neil Adams. And so that's just another barrier that he broke down. So he worked on the X-Men and the Avengers at Marvel kind of at the same time he was doing the Batman books and the Green Lantern, Green Arrow books, which we should definitely talk about at some point. Neil passed away real recently, just a little over a year ago in April of 2022. He was 80 years old. Denny O'Neill was born in 1939 in St. Louis. He worked for a newspaper.
Yeah.
And during, I guess, the slow summer months, he wrote an article, a story on comics, which was seen by Roy Thomas, who is another legendary comic figure who was just beginning to work for Marvel, I think, at that time. And Roy hooked up with Denny and brought him into Marvel. And Denny did a little bit of work for Marvel. He wrote those X-Men books with Neil Adams. That was their first collaboration. Mm-hmm. And then eventually the work kind of dried up there. Denny went to work for Charlton Comics and then over to DC, where he worked for many years. He would go back to Marvel and then back to DC. He's mostly associated with Batman. And he did some key work with Daredevil and other characters at Marvel. But really, if people know Denny O'Neill at all, they know him for his years of not just writing Batman, but being the editor of the Batman books for decades.
Yeah.
And he's one of my favorite people in the history of comics, just as a person. I would recommend anyone who really wants to dig deeper. Kevin Smith, right? We all know Kevin Smith, the director and comic book fan and pop culture gadfly. He does a podcast that used to be called Fat Man on Batman.
Yes.
It's now called Fat Man Beyond. But years ago, when it was still Fat Man on Batman, he did an interview with Denny O'Neill that was about 3 hours long, stretched over two episodes.
Yes.
And he just really great questions, and he just let Denny talk, and you will learn so much about the history of comics and about not just Denny, but just, you know, everything that sort of happened during the years he spent in comics, which is a long time.
Yeah.
And Denny is just a great human being. And I highly recommend seeking out those two episodes of Fat Man on Batman, because they are well worth. Neil Adams was also on Fat Man on Batman more than once, I think.
Yep,
and those are worth listening to, but particularly the Denny O'Neill interviews. Check those out, because he's a kind of a comic book. I don't really have heroes, but he's somebody I look up to in the business and respect a lot.
Before we wrap this up, I want to mention as a side note that if you want to follow this up, the following issue of Batman number 245 from October 72 features a story called the Bruce Wayne Murder Case, in which Batman has to kind of bring Bruce Wayne back from the dead, but it gets complicated. Written by Denny O'Neill, penciled by Neil Adams. I'm not going to get into a synopsis here, but at the very end of the issue, all of a sudden, Bruce Wayne shows up out of nowhere, all smiles. Hey, I'm back. And, you know, it's all kind of resolved, because they don't. Obviously, they never followed up on the Bruce Wayne being killed off kind of thing.
Right. Yep. Yep. And that's a great cover to that issue.
Yes.
Too. Classic.
Neil Adams
cover. Genius cover design and work. Yep.
Yep. Now, we were talking before the podcast, Brad and myself, and we were saying how what we're going to do to give you guys a heads up, we're going to tell you what the next episode is going to be about so you guys can read up. You'll have a month to read up on it. And that way, when we do the podcast, you can kind of follow along. You'll know what we're talking about. So, Brad, why don't you tell the listeners what the next episode of Back Issue Banter is going to be all about?
Yeah, so this episode was Chris's choice. Next episode will be my choice. And I have chosen Amazing Spider-Man issues 31, 32, and 33. It's a story sort of known as the Master Planner saga, but that's what we'll be reading. So if you'd like to follow along or be prepped for the next episode, seek those issues out. They have been reprinted multiple times. Oh, yeah. Guarantee you've seen some of this work reprinted and in images, and even paid homage to in the films. So Amazing Spider-Man 31 through 33, that's next on the agenda for the next episode of Back Issue Banter.
Oh, God, look at the things I have to do for this show. Forced to reread some classic Ditko Spider-Man comics. Oh, my God. Oh, Brad, how can you do this to me? No, that's going to be a lot of fun. I haven't read those in such a long time. I probably have those in at least. I know I have the Masterworks, so at the very least, I can pull my old Marvel Masterworks. And I'll, you know, knowing me, I'll probably end up reading the whole damn book. But, you know.
Yeah.
But that's that's going to be a lot of fun, and that'll be next month. We'll talk about Stan Lee and Steve Ditko's one of their great storylines on the Amazing Spider-Man during the classic years, or the gestation period. And with that, we finish up this really great episode of Back Issue Banter. I'm Chris Karam.
And I'm Brad Page.
And we'll see you next time. Make sure you read up for the next one, folks, because if you don't, there's nothing we can do about it.
Thanks, everyone.
Mr. K Super Show. If you love the music of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, join me every month when I and a guest co-host discuss music and music-related pop culture. No stone goes unturned, no bit of trivia is too trivial as we discuss the great music of Generation X, hosted by Chris Cara. Mr. K Super Show can be found on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are hosted. Check it out. You may not regret it.
Hey, this is Brad Page from the I'm in Love with That Song podcast, inviting you to join me as we explore a different song each episode, discovering what makes these songs great. The performances, arrangements, and the production tricks and techniques are all part of creating those magic moments that turn a good song into a great one. On this podcast, we take a deep dive into each song, listening to all those nuances that came together to make it a great song. Our journey takes us across the musical map, from the Beatles and the Stones to Aretha Franklin and Tom Petty, from Aerosmith to the Zombies. We listen to it all on the I'm in Love with That Song podcast.
Thank you for listening to Back Issue Banter. If you like what you heard, please post a review on Apple Podcasts and please share on social media. On behalf of Brad Page and myself, Chris Karam, thanks once again for listening to Back Issue Banter.